Rising Christian Fellowship in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, Sunday, October 18th, 2009.
Exciting experience to have a venture in faith, to have God speak to you, and then as God has spoken to your heart about something, then you step out in faith, and as you step out in faith, you watch God work. And that's what happens here at this time in the nation of Israel in an incredible way. And I think personally this text is timely for us too, and we'll see as we go. But let's start reading in verse 16 of 1 Samuel chapter 13. Saul, Jonathan his son, and the people present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Then raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned onto the road to Ophrah, to the land of Sheol. Another company turned to the road to Beth Horon. And another company turned to the road of the border that overlooks the valley of Zeboim towards the wilderness. Now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make swords or spears." But the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for a sharpening was a pim for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to set the points of the goads. So it came about on the day of the battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. You might recall in our last study, a large force has come out against the people of Israel at this particular time. Back in chapter 13, we read there were at least 3,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and a vast army. The way the writer, the compiler of this book says it, is in verse 5 of chapter 13, that the army was so vast, it was as if the seashore in multitude, you know, was, you look at the sands of the seashore. Just vast, a large army. But we also know, and you see that in here in this passage, that the Philistine army was superior in their weapons. And we've noted this, but it comes out very clear here in this text. If you know your history, and I'm not a real history buff, but I enjoy history, but you're at a time period where the people of Israel are now, where you've got the Bronze Age ending and you have the Iron Age starting. And you can study that, maybe you remember it from your high school, but it's about this time. And it seems, putting it together, and there seems to be a lot of historical indications of this, and that is that the Philistines have entered into the Iron Age, but the people of Israel haven't. The Iron Age, the iron metallurgy started in Europe, and if you know anything about iron, we all do, but prior to this, you had the Bronze Age. Bronze Age went on for thousands of years, and clearly the people of Israel had swords and weapons, but they've been made of bronze. But in Europe, there was this advanced development of iron. And you make a weapon out of iron, obviously you have a superior weapon indeed. And it seems even indicated in this text that the Philistines had developed iron weapons. And possibly they had traded, they were seafaring people, they had traded with the Europeans. Or possibly when they conquered the Hittites to the north, some indications the Hittites had iron. And had early on in the Iron Age had developed iron. But the Philistines were the first ones in the region of the land of Canaan to develop this technology of iron metallurgy, the Iron Age. So they have these superior weapons. And you can see in this passage, note in verse 19, there's no blacksmith to be found in Israel. And that wouldn't be uncommon for an empire. You see it at different times or a nation when you've subdued another nation. If you had superior technology, to keep that technology from them. And so it appears that the Philistines have done that. The people of Israel have been subdued by them, have been diminished by them, to the point that they're not even able to develop probably even bronze instruments. As you see, there's no blacksmith. In order for them to even sharpen their weapons, they have to go to the Philistines to sharpen even their farming tools, as you see there in verse 20. And the charge for even sharpening of a farming tool was a pim, which evidently was an exorbitant price. So you've got this tremendous military. They've got chariots. They've got horses. They've got superior weapons. But then we even note further that that the people of Israel have been reduced to only two swords, at least as far as the 600 men that are with Saul and with Jonathan. There's two swords, two spears, or essentially a couple spears and a couple swords, and they alone reside with Saul and with Jonathan. Now, that's a pretty dismal situation. You know, 600 people, I've got a sword, you've got a spear, two of us, and we're looking out at 3,000 chariots, hundreds of horsemen, and a massive army. And that's all we got. We can't even develop anything, sharpen anything. It's a pretty pitiful sight, isn't it? As you understand, maybe if you've studied this before, it's a real pitiful sight. And, you know, you look at that, and my title of this study is A Venture in Faith. I really love the text because of how many times it's ministered to me in my life. But this is the background for A Venture in Faith. When we speak of ventures in faith, it usually has a backdrop to it like this, where there is this tremendous need. It always starts with a need, a venture in faith, where somebody understands and discerns and looks at a situation and sees a pitiful situation maybe, or just a tremendous need, and then God begins to speak to them. And what starts is a work of God, where God is glorified in a powerful way, using a human as an instrument. You know, maybe you get the Send magazine. I enjoy the Send magazine, K.P. Yohannan's magazine, Gospel for Asia. And this latest issue just came out. You know, the cover of the magazine, if you get it, you might have noted it. Maybe you read it. But it says, Children in Crisis, Bringing God's Love to the Least of These, Children in Crisis. And you have a picture like the Slumdog Millionaire. You have a couple, you know, pictures at the beginning, a picture on the cover of children in Asia that are in just dismal situations. You know, two boys, one picture walking by a train station in India, and you can tell they probably have worn their clothes for just about forever, and they're very poor. And so this magazine focused on these kids. And K.P. Yohannan in the magazine gives the statistics that there are 250 million child laborers today in the world. 250 million, that's almost the population of the United States. Slave laborers, you know, the Slumdog Millionaire. I didn't see the movie, but I heard about it. And I guess it's pretty accurate, even K.P. Yohannan, depicting the abuse of these children, their incredibly horrible existence, the things that happened to them. I remember living in, when I lived in San Diego and attended Horizon in San Diego, when Mike McIntosh shared one Sunday about the kids in Brazil, and there are so many like that, and I learned later that's all over the globe, but, you know, people take advantage, adults take advantage of these street kids. In some instances, get them addicted to, you know, industrial glue. And so the kids want that glue and will do anything for that glue because they're addicted to it. And then these adults abuse them and do horrible things with them. And I remember Mike McIntosh sharing one Sunday about the kids in Brazil and wanting to set up a tent city in Brazil to somehow try to minister to these kids and spare these kids. But a dismal situation on the globe, 250 million. Slave kids, child labor, 250 million, almost the population of the United States. Well, K.P. Yohannan, the editor-in-chief of the magazine, so you open it up and he's got the words on the inside cover, he says this, recently the Lord once again brought to my heart the harsh reality of little boys and girls all across Asia who are being exploited by the very adults who should be their protectors. Young, helpless, innocent, naive, these children are forced into virtual slavery for the sake of greed and power. But Jesus Christ looks at children differently. During his earthly journey, he always defended the vulnerable and the downtrodden and orphans and widows. As his followers, let us feel the sorrow he feels. And in his name, let us care for the abandoned ones and loved ones and love the neglected ones. It's our awesome privilege to welcome them into our lives. And as we do, we welcome the Lord himself into our lives. So K.P. Yohannan goes on and shares the magazine. He has a vision to reach 500,000, at least in his life, in his ministry, of these kids. 500,000. But it starts with that. You know, a venture in faith starts with, often the picture is pretty dismal. The situation is grave, or the need is incredibly great. It starts with a need. And K.P. Yohannan in that magazine, and here in the nation of Israel, it's a horrible situation for the people of God. But then we start, as God is ministering to this man, Cape Yohanan, we see now, as we go to the next chapter, God has found a heart and he begins to stir in our heart. Chapter 14, starting with verse 1. Now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side." But he did not tell it to his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest, and Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. So you start the next text, the next story is a man, presumably a young man, the son of Saul, and it seems that the Holy Spirit is beginning to prompt him and stir his heart. And that is where it starts. And we go on. There is a God prompting going on in his heart, and he's responding to the God prompting. But you know, you could ask the question, why Jonathan and why not Saul? You know, Saul's the king. He's the guy that God has anointed originally. I mean, he's a head and taller than anybody in Israel. He's the leader. Why not Saul? And I believe the reason, and it becomes evident as you read the text, and that is because his son Jonathan, has a greater heart for the things of God than Saul does. I think it becomes clear. And that's how God works. God, as you know, going back, you might remember in the last chapter, chapter 13, verse 14, God said in his own words, "The Lord has sought for himself a man." And what kind of man? After his own heart. God looks for somebody who has a heart for the things of God, and has that, the God heart, you know, and God looks for that person, and he uses people like that. As we go on, Saul is losing his senses, and we'll see that as we go on. His heart seemed to start okay, but we already started to note in the last study that there was just a carnality, and there was compromise already entering into his life. And by the time you get to this text, you see that his concern is his kingdom, and it isn't really even God's kingdom. But he's got a son, and we don't know how it happens, but Jonathan has a very different heart. And in the situation, I mean, it's dismal for the people of God. They're so outnumbered. But he understands certain things about God and the heart of God and the power of God. And so God comes and realizes that in his heart and begins to stir his heart and mind. And a venture in faith always starts that way. You know, it always happens where God finds that heart and begins to stir the heart. And a vision is given. And that's what you see here is what's beginning is a vision. And it starts to lay out as we go on. He has certain thoughts. It's God revealing certain things to him. And it's the beginning of a vision. A vision for how God could just yet work at this time. Now, how did he receive it? We don't know exactly. We're not told how the prompting starts. But, you know, God can do it in many different ways. But it starts, again, in a heart that's seeking after the things of God. And I think it's often correlated to prayer. Not always. But when you find in a story where God, you know, begins to stir somebody's heart and to raise them up to use them and in an adventure in faith, you'll find it's often related to prayer, at least correlated to prayer. And maybe this man has just been burdened for his people and has been sitting there and reading the Bible and praying and he's burdened. And so God begins to speak to him. You know, the Send magazine, K.P. Yohanan, you know, prayer and how God has used him, there's a connection. I'll just read to you. At the end of the same magazine, there's this page, the last page, the inside cover, it says 5 minutes with KP, a journey in faith. And the opening paragraph, the journey begins, is the heading of that paragraph. And here's his own words, KP Yohanan. And you guys might remember Gospel for Asia. One of his men came here and shared about India a number of months ago. "During the last year of my pastorate, I received a burden and a call from God to give the rest of my life to reach the millions of the unreached people in the nations of Asia with the gospel. The year was 1979. And then we read this. I prayed and fasted for God's specific leading and timing, and as a result, our Tuesday evening prayer meeting was born. The main purpose for this prayer meeting was to seek God's guidance for every new step on this journey of faith which we had begun. Our Tuesday evening prayer meeting still continues today in all the nations where we work, both in the East and in the West. Back then it was my wife, Gilza, our little boy, Daniel, and a handful of God's people. But today, tens of thousands around the world join us as a family and as a community of Christ called to impact his generation. Just a few people. His heart is stirring, and he's begun to seek God in prayer on Tuesday nights. And now there's thousands that do the same Tuesday night prayer. And as you know, Gospel for Asia, I think they're what, up to 14, 15,000 missionaries, and they have 50,000 kids they're reaching right now in camps and, these Sunday schools, and they've planted so many churches. Even today while we're here, I think a dozen churches will be planted in India just today, every day, through the Gospel for Asia ministry. Started with a little short Indian pastor, but he grew up barefoot in India with hardly any money. But 1979, seeking God. You can hear him at conferences. Some of us have been at conferences and spoken to him, but just seeking the Lord and wanting the heart of God and actually ministering in the States at the time. And God began to give him a vision for the people of Asia, and God has then been using that. But it birthed in prayer, started in prayer, and then all that's happened as a result. Here's a man, Jonathan, and there's promptings and stirrings in his heart, and the need is great all around him. I look at that, and I read that, and I've now been in ministry for 15 years, and I have absolutely no idea God has called me, and I have so many shortcomings. But yet, there have been times in my little life where I've just been seeking the Lord and been burned about something and had the experience of God speaking to me. And then, looking at a large situation, sensing God's leading, and then beginning to follow it through and watching God work in a supernatural way. I've seen it happen a number of times, even coming here and being part of this today. You know, as you guys know the story, but I didn't know I'd be doing this. I was just out there hanging out and working for a company in the West Coast with my wife, and God began to speak to me actually in a times of prayer. I didn't expect it. And so then I just began to take little steps of faith, and God began to work. The radio we do on the Cape, you know, it started with little promptings and seasons of prayer, and then God began to move, and God began to speak. There are a lot of stories. We'll note some things as we go on. But note here, there's a great need, and then there's a man that's got some thoughts, and they're heavenly thoughts that God's put into his heart. But his dad is just sitting there under a pomegranate tree. It does seem to be quite a contrast. His boy is making steps, stirring, Saul sitting, and I think it's because Saul has a very different heart at this time. But the people of God really need somebody to lead them. Verse 4, between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of one is Bozez, and the name of the other, Sina. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of the uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few." He's got a stirring in his heart. And what happens, and it happens with any venture in faith, he then begins to take steps of faith. He doesn't just sit there and let his mind and heart stir. He begins to step out and begins to follow little promptings. And that's always key to a venture in faith. I remember being at a men's conference, men's retreat actually, at Calvary Boston in 2004. Sandy Adams, a pastor from Georgia, was sharing, and he said this statement: "A dream without determination makes only a visionary. Determination without a dream makes a mercenary. But a dream with determination makes a missionary." I'll say it to you again. A dream without determination makes only a visionary. Determination without a dream makes a mercenary. But a dream with determination makes a missionary. The point being, God might prompt your heart, but if you don't respond, what's it going to mean? But if you try to jump out and do something on your own without God's leading, you're in trouble. But if God's stirring your heart and you respond, you now become an instrument in his hand. You'll see God work. He has these stirrings, the visions forming within him, and he starts to take some, just to kind of start with it. So what he does is he heads out with his armor bearer, and they start to head over towards the garrison the garrison of the Philistines. Now, prior to this, in chapter 13, he's already attacked him once. But now we appreciate the odds that the people of Israel are up against and the fact that he would even go over and do this. But as he's going out to check out the position of the enemy, as he goes through this particular area of geography, he notes some things that are fascinating to him, and it draws his attention to those. And I'm sure it's the Lord working, but he comes to this place in this area of Michmash where there's on two sides these large rock outcroppings. And evidently, I've never been to this part of Israel, but if you go to this part of Israel, you'll see in this region, on both sides, these large outcroppings of rocks. And it catches his attention, and evidently, if you see them, you can understand that if you were positioned as a military on one of those ridges, you would have a tremendous advantage from a military standpoint. But he notes that, and his attention is drawn to it, and because his attention is drawn to it, things stir even further now. And he says to his arm bearer, it's amazing that he says this. Basically, he says, hey, maybe God will do something. Maybe God will even use us. Let's go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised, and maybe the Lord will do something. And he makes that tremendous statement. Hey, with God, it doesn't matter how many people are on the team. It doesn't matter what the odds are. It doesn't matter how great the need. God can do anything he wants to do. Amen. He can use one or two. He can use many. That's really not the issue. Now, to say that and believe it, you know, you can have a Bible study and say, God can do anything. He sits on his throne. He's almighty. He's all powerful. He's omnipotent. You can have Bible studies all day long and talk about that stuff all day long. It's a whole nother to be in a situation where it takes a miracle. And you're stepping, he's stepping, if he steps ahead, he's putting his life in danger. He's putting his life at risk. He's laying his life on the altar. But yet he has an understanding that, you know, these are the enemies of God. And God wants to deliver his people, and God can do it with just the two of us if he wants to. That's incredible. That's incredible. And it's true even today. Amen. It's true with 250 million kids in slavery or being abused on the planet. It's true. It's true with the great needs that we see in our own community. It's true with the great needs we see in our nation. It's true. It's true no matter what the situation might be, no matter how ominous the darkness and the enemy and the power and the grip of the darkness, doesn't matter. God still sits on his throne. He's the creator of the heavens and the earth. And he just might use you if you're willing to be used. Those little promptings and just following that, there's a lot of stories in this church. But I think of the one time with 2004 or 3, whatever the year was. I guess it was 4. But the whole issue with same-sex marriage, which I'm not ashamed to say is still a burden on my heart. Really burdens me that this is going on in our culture, though God loves everybody. But I do believe it's the undermining of our nation if we don't change the direction. But I remember when it got started, and I remember being burdened, and I was really burdened by it. Maybe it was the Lord. And I didn't know what to do. I just was thinking, God, you know, it's like, even at the time, the people in Massachusetts, we looked at the statistics, the people in Massachusetts didn't want it. But the state Supreme Court was going to force it on us anyway. And I remember being burdened. And then one day I was sitting in my office, and I had been praying, and I got a phone call, and somebody in our church was burdened. And at that particular time, our state house, they had the opportunity maybe to do some things to stop it. And they had met their con, you know, they had met, and they couldn't come up with a decision, and they were going to reconvene in 30 days. And so that had happened, and now it's that 30-day period, and you're wondering what's going to happen. Are they going to come up with a decision? The people are against this as a majority anyway at the time. And so I get a call, and it's somebody in our church. And it was Donna Fisher. I remember she just called up. She goes, you know, don't you think we should be doing something? Now, what do you do in that case? What do you do? I don't know. So we talked a little bit, and I hung up the phone. And I just thought about prayer. I think about all we can do is pray. We could gather people for prayer. And so the thoughts just started coming to my mind. Let's just invite people to prayers. And I thought, where's a good place? Civic Center. Let's do that. Now, at that time, we'd never done, you know, hey, trying to do concerts in this area, Christian concerts. I remember doing a lot of concerts and trying to gather people and, you know, pulling up to the parking lot, and there'd be like three cars there and going, man, we spent thousands of dollars. And then looking at the empty sanctuary going or auditorium going, nobody's come. How do you gather people, man? And never really had a lot of success at that before. But I thought, the Civic Center, maybe. So I called Lemister Assembly, Mark Boucher. I said, this is my thoughts. What do you think? So I'm just starting to take it a little further. He goes, if you do it, we'll do it. All right. So then I went over to the Civic Center. And I remember coming into it. And now I'm starting down that road thinking, yeah, we'll rent the Civic Center. What does it cost? Well, it costs thousands of dollars. And we don't have the money. But I remember sitting there in the Civic Center looking around going, this is a big place, man. When about the biggest crowd we've ever been able to pull together at events like 50 people, this seats thousands. I remember thinking, what do we do, Lord? But I had this stirring in my heart. And so just started to make more phone calls, and you're within like 4 weeks from when the ConCon's going to meet, and started to talk to people, decided on March 10th, we'd do this thing, and we called it Pray for Marriage, and we just had a few weeks, and let's just get the word out as best we can. But those of you who are here, it's just an example of a venture in faith. So I use it at this point, but things just started to happen. I remember, signing the lease for that facility and looking at the price tag for that. But we're going to do it. And then one day, a couple days later, walking by a newspaper stand in Leominster and seeing the heading. Right there, main heading, the Central Enterprise. Pastor, something like that, group, going to have a thing on the same-sex marriage thing at the Civic Center. And I'm like, what? Got the newspaper? I'm like, hey, that's about us. And then it just started to hit the newspapers. Telephones started to ring with interviews. Even TV stations eventually get involved. Sky Angel TV, the last week, decides to air it nationally on all their things. And I remember walking into that stadium. It was 4 weeks. There were people here working so hard. We were staying up late. Now we need video cameras. I mean, we need cameras because it's going to be on Sky Angel TV. We need a camera crew. We need a satellite trucks. It just started to snowball. Now in Boston, they're getting satellite trucks at Calvary Boston to do a downlink there. And this is all in just weeks with no money, but just the prompting started it. And I remember at the beginning walking out onto the stage, and we had set out 1,000 chairs, and you have the stadium around it. And okay, Lord, here we are. And at that time, there's 21 pastors on stage. A couple of state representatives were there. And God just began to bring the people. And I remember each time looking out when I shared or just sitting there on the stage watching the people just keep coming in. But it was a venture in faith for me. And it was a venture in faith for those of us that got involved. But I could just go on and on with other stories. And you know what was the fruit of that? I think the fruit of that was it stirred the heart of the church. We sought the Lord, cried out to God. He says, nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. Quantities don't matter in God's economy. God can use a Gideon's army. God can use a Jonathan. He can take a few fish and a few loaves and multiply it and feed a multitude. Problem is we get caught up in the paralysis of analysis. That's Joe Foch's words. I was listening to him this week on this. We looked at a difficult situation and we're like, that costs a lot of money. That requires a lot of people. That requires a lot of resources. The odds just don't work out. And we get caught up in the paralysis and analysis, and we don't do anything. But Jonathan believes the Lord and trusts the Lord. You know, faith is a big, big, big key here, right? His faith, the steps of faith. We see his faith here. And you remember Jesus, you know, without it, it's debilitating if we don't have faith. Remember Jesus said in Matthew 13, verse 58, that in that particular time of his ministry, where it's said about him that he did not do many mighty works because of their unbelief. And what restrains restrains God from working at times is man's unbelief. God chooses then not to work and not to act, but what he looks for is somebody who will believe and somebody who will trust, and then he uses that instrument. And well, Jonathan, verse 7, so his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart. Go then. Here I am with you according to your heart. And Jonathan said, very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. It is amazing, his armor bearer. I mean, this guy's going to go against the enemy and says, hey, you want to come with me? But his armor bearer says, let's do it. Those are great friends to have. I think historically we've had elders like that in this church, man, that there have been times where we're looking at a tremendous situation and, you know, my heart's prompted and a couple of us, and I watch these elders that we've had, they're like, yep, that's the will of God. Let's just go for it. God will work it out. And I pray we continue to have leadership like that. So, very well, Jonathan says. Now, what we see as he steps out is we see God confirming. And that's important, too, in adventure and faith. That's what, you know, as the heart is stirred and you take steps of faith, then God starts to confirm. And that's an important part of this whole process. He says, very well, as if his armor bearer is part of the confirmation. His armor bearer now is confirming. Let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden. Obviously a very demeaning way of saying that. Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his arm bearer and said, come up to us and we'll show you something. You see the pride of the enemy, the confidence of the enemy. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. So he steps out and he starts to see God move in confirmations that increases his faith and confirm to his spirit that God is with me. And when God is with you, you can do anything that God calls you to do. He brings the confirmation. And he also only goes to a certain point seeking further confirmation. He just doesn't go bonsai nutty, and he wants and waits to ensure God is with him. And that's important. You know, I remember feeling called to the ministry and wondering if I was, and all these things stirring on my heart. And a good pastor friend of mine even said, your confirmation will come in your wife. And you guys know, I share it at times, but that was a miracle if it was going to happen, because my wife so much did not want to even be part of ministry, be married to a pastor. And as I've shared, I brought it up to her, and she just cried, man. She didn't perish the thought, you know, of even the possibility of leaving California and going into ministry and leaving our jobs. And so I was wrestling through this, and a good friend, pastor friend, said to me, your confirmation, if God is calling you to do this, he'll confirm it with your wife. That took a miracle. It took a miracle for that to happen. But one day, walking out of church, I didn't even know it, but God had been really working on my wife's heart. We came walking out, and she turned to me. She said, you know what? This church has an internship, pastoral internship program. You need to apply to it. And I knew then something seriously has happened. And I yet knew then, I have a desire. I believe it's the Lord. And I think you're actually starting to open the door. You're confirming it. And so Jonathan goes to a place now and says, hey, listen, this is what we'll do. We'll reveal ourselves. We'll there they are. Some of the troops are up there. We'll stand in front of them. Let them see us. And if they say to us, come up to us, then what I have in my heart, that just seems to affirm to me that God is saying, go for it. If they're like, we're going to come down to you. Wait, I don't think we're supposed to do this, but let's just see. And these prideful Philistines go, come on up, we'll show you the ticket, not realizing. John's like, God's got you, man. God's with me. I've had that sort of thing happen. I remember one time in 1998, we had invited John Eppolito over. Our church is just a little tiny church, a very new church. He was the president or the overseer of the Calvary Chapel Bible College in Switzerland and was over in the States, and I had a burden for Europe. And so he shares at our little church in Leominster, where we're renting out a karate studio, and shares one night. And And so we pray for him at the end. Bill Smith, who used to be one of our leaders, is now pastoring in North Dakota. Him and I come up to pray for Frank Eppolito at the end, and we're done praying, and Frank Eppolito, when the service is all done, he says, "I just have to say something," and he says it to all of us. He says, "York, England. I just feel I need to tell you that." That's all he said, "York, England." Well, not realizing that Bill, who was praying on the other side of him, was married to a woman from England. And I know that Bill has a burden for Scotland and that part of the world, Britain. And so I looked right at Bill when he said that. Frank Eppolito, and I said, "Bill, maybe this is a word from God. Tell you what, we'll just test it and see." We talked after. "If you can get cheap tickets, let's go to York, England." Now, cheap tickets to Europe. What's a cheap ticket? Well, Bill calls me a couple days later and says, "I just found tickets for $250. I'm like, "That's cheap tickets to England. Round trip." Oh, yeah. So we went to that point. And now we're gonna just about order the tickets. Well, one of the reasons why Frank mentioned that, and I found out later too, is this guy named Dave Sylvester was just getting started with a church in York, and he just knew him and loved him and felt prompted to just say that to us. Well, I learned then about this guy, Dave Sylvester, starting a church that's similar to ours in York, England. So I then said to Bill, I said, "Bill, listen, let's not buy the tickets until we do this. You call that guy up, Dave Sylvester, and just see, just talk to him, mention we might come over to York and just see what happens. We'll see if God invites us over, you know what I mean?" Same sort of thing. We opened this text right here, and I said, "Look, we'll see if we're invited over." Bill calls Dave Sylvester, and then talks to him, calls me. He says, "Hey, I mentioned it to this guy, Dave, and we're coming over." And Dave is pretty excited. In fact, he wants you to teach on Sunday morning. Now, the guy didn't even know me. Well, I'm like, "Well, that's pretty, now we have an invitation." So we buy $250 tickets. We go over. Their little church is in the old Roman wall, a 2,000-year-old wall that goes around the city. Right inside the wall. Never knew there'd be a church in a wall. I sleep inside the wall, because I haven't studied yet, which I just can't do at the last minute, even when I'm visiting. And so I have to sleep in the church that Saturday night to put my message together. But I share on Sunday morning. We hang out with Dave. Now we're only over there for a few days. We're coming back. I'm like, "Well, did we just come over to teach? There's got to be more to it." So we're on our last day, and I'm with Dave, and I'm wondering in my mind, why am I here? Well, shares a story about this couple whom I met, a young couple who's come over from another part of Europe to minister with them, and they have very little money. They're a young couple, but because they have very little money and the church has no money, this couple's rented a part of a flat, which is an apartment in that part of the world, and they're with college students, and they're all these single non-Christian guys that have this apartment, and this young couple, Christian couple, are living with them. And he's like, "You know, I'm burdened about that, you know, but we can't do anything about it." And so he says, "You know, there are people that like to come help, but it's just, you know, we don't have any resources." And so we started to talk, and I said, "Well, what if you had like a place for them to stay? Missionaries like this couple." And we talked, and I said, "Well, what would it cost to rent out one of these flats? What's the fee?" And he said, "Well, a typical flat in York goes for about $800 a month." I said, $800 a month. Well, all right. So I get on the plane. I'm flying back with Bill. And I started to think, $800 a month. If they had $800 a month, they could have a flat. And missionaries could come stay with them and help. And so I'm talking with Bill on the plane. I'm like, "Bill, you know, $800 a month, that's a week's offering for our church at that time, a little church. What if we started now as a small church and start our missions budget and just start giving 1 week's offering a month? And we'll start with this. And if we start now, you know, we'd be able to maintain it later as we grow." Got back, talked with the leaders, shared it with the church, and that's what we started to do. Dave rented this, found a flat, started to rent it, called it a missions house. And what happened over the following years, all sorts of missionaries stayed there. And people I even know. And that little church had a big team around it now, and that church has grown. There's a Bible college. And for years, I'd get reports from Dave of this missions house that our church paid all the bills for when we were just yet a small church. And how God used it, and I'd get emails from people staying there, missionaries, and just thanking us. But it was a venture in faith. Started with a word at a Sunday service. Never knew I'd go to York, England. Didn't know it would happen that way. Well, you know, a lot of different things we could talk about. Let's just move here in verse 13. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter with Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about a half acre of land. So you go up these cliffs here and go up to these formations of rocks. Evidently, it takes today you look at it, you'd say it'd take an expert climber to go up there. It is quite steep. So Jonathan actually climbs up, which is quite a thing, with his armor bearer. And it seems that when they get at the top, maybe Jonathan with his spear and then the armor bearer following with a sword, and Jonathan's knocking him over and messing with him with his spear, and then the armor bearer's come behind and killing him, or vice versa, something like that. But in an amazing way, they kill 20 men, soldiers, just like that. And so what's happening, and as you see as you read on, is as they begin to go forward in a radical way in faith, God's power begins to be seen in a way that it isn't his swordsmanship. He's made it very clear. God can save by few. He knows this is a God work. When they give the word to come up, he knows God has delivered them into our hand. And so they began to see the power of God. And so, verse 15, and God's power is seen even more. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and raiders also trembled. And the earth quaked so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here," for at that time the ark of God was with the children of Israel. It seems like the Septuagint here, the old Greek translation, says ephod, not the ark of God, and it might have been the ephod, just the priest with his ephod. Verse 19. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to battle. And indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was a very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth-Aven. So God's power is seen. In fact, they start in a very tremendous way just to kill 20 soldiers. And then what happens is there's this great trembling, debate as to whether it's just confusion that hits the camp or it's actually an earthquake, and it certainly could be because we've seen that happen at other times. But God's power is manifested. And a huge army goes into confusion. They had only two swords, maybe a couple spears with the people of Israel. But what God does is actually takes the spears of the enemy, their superior technology, their iron, and God turns their spears on one another. So the Philistines start fighting each other. And they destroy each other is what really happens. And then what happens further, when you have a venture in faith, where God finds a man or a woman that has the faith to trust God for great and mighty things, and God then speaks to them, and they step out, and God's power begins to be seen, what then happens is then others begin to join in. And there were Israelites that were hiding in caves. There were Israelites that had actually joined up with the enemy because in fear, you know, they're thinking, well, they're obviously going to, they're in charge, so we'll go with the guys that are winning here. And then when the tides turn, they now change and go back to being with the people of Israel. But all these people, Saul also and his troops join in and they go after the Philistines, and there's a tremendous victory, a tremendous work. And Josephus, this ancient historian, says 6,000 of the Philistines were killed that day. 6,000. You got two guys with weapons, 6,000 end up dying of the enemy. And obviously, that's a work of God. There's a venture in faith, and God responded, and God is glorified. Notice in verse 23, so the Lord saved Israel. There's a story back in World War I, where a military leader was reading this text, was in this part of Israel and looked at this and decided to use Jonathan's perspective here. And I'll just read to you the story real quick. This is taken from the account. This is from Major Vivian Gilbert. This is his story. And he was a British Army officer. In the First World War, a brigadier major in Allenby's army in Palestine was on one occasion searching his Bible with the light of a candle looking for a certain name. His brigade had received orders to take a village that stood on a rocky prominence on the other side of a deep valley. It was called Michmash, and the name seemed somewhat familiar. Eventually, he found it in 1 Samuel 13 and read there, "And Saul and Jonathan, his son, and the people that were present with him, abode in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines camped in Michmash." It then went on to tell how Jonathan and his armor bearer crossed over during the night to the Philistine garrison on the other side, and how they passed two sharp rocks. There was a sharp rock on one side and then a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sinan. They clambered up the cliff and overpowered the garrison within a half acre of land. The main body of the enemy, awakened by the melee, thought that they were surrounded by Saul's troops and melted away, and they went beating down on one another. Thereupon, Saul attacked with his whole force and beat the enemy, so the Lord saved Israel. Well, the brigade major reflected that there must still be this narrow passage through the rocks between two spurs, and at the end of it, the half acre of land. He woke the commander, and there read the passage through together once more. Patrols were sent out. They found the pass, which was thinly held by the Turks, and which led past two jagged rocks, obviously Bozez and Sina. Up on the top, beside Michmash, they could see by the light of the moon a small flat field. The brigadier altered his plan of attack. Instead of deploying the whole brigade, he sent one company through the pass under the cover of darkness. The few Turks whom they met were overpowered without a sound. The cliffs were scaled, and shortly before daybreak, the company had taken up the position on the half-acre land. Well, the Turks woke up and took to their heels in disorder, since they thought that they were being surrounded by Allenby's army. They were all killed or taken prisoner, and so after thousands of years, British troops successfully copied the tactics of Saul and Jonathan. And that is in the Bible as history by Keller. So interesting, huh? Story. Well, you know what? I got a lot more to share, but we are out of time, and I'm not going to do that to you. So let's stand up.
Horizon Christian Fellowship in Fitchburg, Massachusetts can be contacted online at horizonfitchburg.org or by calling 978-665-9111. Our service times are 8:45 and 11 a.m. on Sundays and 7 p.m. on Wednesdays.